Blog Talk Radio.
It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh. And I'm feeling good.
Arkansas and around this on this hill. But Billy Day kids going back to school, floods, and I told you hurricane coming back to back over. We had a bad hurricane that come over in Haiti and is on its way here to America. Gonna hit Mississippi, some part of Alabama, some part of Louisiana, some part of Georgia, and then London on its way. The fire out in California and the flood and the fire. God is totally in control. This is divine healing night. If you got a need, you plant a seed. Go to my website, theseedofabrahamyosac.com, and go to my PayPal. Else you can write me, Post Office Box 299097, Chicago, Illinois, 60628. Get your letter in. I got some of your letters. I want to begin to pray for the letters going into 2022, 2021. We're getting ready to pray and put you before God. If you got a need, you plant a seed. And I want you to seed quick, fast, and in a hurry. And, you know, I just feel like seeding is the way I believe in harvest. I believe in if you got some seed and you plant those seeds, it's going to come up for harvest. You reap what you sow. You got to sow in order to reap. And this month is the month to sow. And going into next month, harvest month, let's get your harvest together. But you need to sow that seed right now, quick, fast, and in a hurry.
And imposed on people by conquerors and used as a framework to control their mind. My main point here is that if you are a child of God and God is a part of you, then in your imagination, God supposed to look like you. And when you accept a picture of the deity assigned to you by another people, you become the spiritual prisoner of that other people. Many Africans became Roman citizens, just like many Black Americans today. I have nothing to do with Africa. I'm an American. I'm a citizen. I'm an American. There were Africans. because way back there, that same kind of split personality silliness, not knowing where the ethnic identity belonged,
Rome's hold over his far-flung provinces weakens. In North Africa, it faces a new and fierce challenge, Islam.
The Arabs, noticing the weakness of the Romans in North Africa, began to quote the favor of the Africans.
Arabs convinced the local black populations to join in the struggle against a common oppressor. They also convinced many of them to abandon their traditional beliefs and pledge their allegiance to Allah.
The Africans assumed that by supporting the Arabs would get the Romans literally off their back. They were right. The Arabs did get the Romans off their back, but the Arabs replaced the Romans on their back. And like most conquerors, they declared war on African culture and ways of life. The Arab has always been a propagator and defender of slavery. They've always rationalized slavery based on Islam. I do not think any religion sanctions slavery. And anytime you use a religion to sanction slavery, you're misusing that religion and misusing the word of God. Well, the Christians did it, and the Arabs have done it, and the Hebrews have done it. It's not right in any case.
Islamic armies, their ranks dominated by African converts, defeat the Romans and push on to the continent of Europe. In the process, they capture Spain. There, the Africans and Arabs create a rich, cultured, and powerful empire. So powerful, it endures for 500 years.
The achievement of the Arabs at this time is they have driven the Europeans out of the Mediterranean. The Europeans now must go back into Europe. They have no empire, no great connections outside of Europe. And because of this, they ultimately would go into a period called the Dark Ages. People are confused because when the European mentioned the Dark Ages for him were not the Dark Ages for other people. Concurrent with his Dark Ages, the African had the Third Golden Age.
As Europe suffers, three great kingdoms are emerging in West Africa, Mele, or Mali, Ghana, and Songhai. These were lands of enormous wealth, generated by their control of the trade routes across the Sahara, and the abundance of their gold mines. The kingdoms were known for their benevolent government and their great respect for learning.
For a while in history, there was only two great universities. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu and the University of Salamanca in Spain. And the African was solely in charge of the one at Sankore and partly in charge of the one at Salamanca.
The Arabs had to some degree institutionalized the practice of African slavery. The Europeans internationalized it. In Europe, the wealth amassed from the slave trade makes the Industrial Revolution possible while laying the foundations of modern capitalism. In the Americas, the traffic in human souls creates a vast African diaspora, millions upon millions of people ripped from their homelands, transported in chains to a distant, hostile world.
The European came into Africa as a guest and was treated as a guest. The Africans are unsuspecting, political, naive, some of them still are, because he had nothing against the Europeans, and he had never enslaved any Europeans. Just assume automatically no European would enslave him. He had never dealt with anyone who would enslave the host and the wife who cooked the meal and lie about it. Around 1442, the first slaves to be taken out of West Spain and Portugal go to the Pope, the leading perpetrator of that day, the one person in Europe with the greatest authority. The Pope would say to Spain and Portugal, you take the East and you take the West, and you two good Catholic nations start fighting on the Then, the profound statement before departure, you are both authorized to reduce to servitude all infidel people. The slave trade now had been sanctioned. Europeans have been told they need not feel guilty. You're doing this to an infidel who is outside of God's grace. England went into the slave trade with a vengeance, led by Captain Hawkins and the good ship Jesus. The ship was called the Good Ship Jesus. The coat of arms on the ship was two Africans bound back to back, the arms tied. So they saw no contradiction being in the slave trade and being Christians at the same time. We cannot deal with this enough because we're still suffering from this inside of the mind of a lot of people in this world, into the millions. We are outside of humanity, outside of the grace of God. That's a terrible feeling as you walk the earth. Because what has been taken away is your essential humanity, your human beingness. When they take away your human beingness, they take away your nationness. Early in the 19th century, the concept of slavery began to yield to the concept of colonialism, a more sophisticated form of slavery. Slavery as a system became unwieldy, and besides the point where it was saturated, everybody who wanted a slave had one, who could afford one. The European nations of size that did not have a portion of Africa began to grumble at the Berlin Conference, 1884 and 1885, the European powers of substance who did not have any part of Africa now was given to part.
Africans did not fall at the feet of European invaders. They fought fiercely, bravely, and continued.
Anti-colonial wars started up down the coast of West Africa, parts of Inner Africa, and in the Congo. Those armed resistance, the Zulu wars, lasted from the 1650s when the Boers arrived to the last Zulu war was 1906. In Ghana, the Ashanti wars lasted from early in the 18th century to the last Ashanti War, led by a woman, Ye Asantewa, in 1900. For a while, it looked as though the Europeans would not be able to hold on to the continent. More manpower, more ruthless treatment brought it mainly under their control. By 1884, 1885, and afterwards, there was no dispute about who was in charge of Africa, just who was in charge of what part of it. We have been hung up with a myth, the myth of the conqueror and the invader as the bringer of civilization. No people ever brought civilization to another people at no time and at no place in history. One of the most has nothing peaceful about aggression. Only the slave can abolish slavery. If someone is on your back, you have to bend a little to balance them on your back. Now, the best move, if you want to get them off of your back, stand straight up. There's something about an island, a body of water, creates a special kind of dream, because they did not know where they came from and out from. They dreamed of the whole of it, bringing all together in one piece. The seeds of Pan-Africanism planted in the United States during slavery years later flourished in the fertile soil of the British West Indies. Trinidad produced the greatest Pan-Africanists, H. Sylvester Williams, C.L.R. James, and George Bazewell. In Trinidad, they found the Pan-African League. H. Sylvester Williams would eventually call it Pan-African. He would call a conference in London in 1900. A few scattered Africans, a few people from the Caribbean, the Beauty Boys from the United States. They did not ask for the independence of African states, man. They asked for preparation. It was the kind of education that will prepare us for a future independence. They were reasonable, but they weren't listened to. And yet the conference made some kind of impression. After the first Congress, two boys would be the key life from the second through fourth. But the most meaningful one, the boys called Barron. As a result of this conference, two boys came to center stage as theater and theoretician of Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanism wasn't exactly new because Black Americans were practicing long before someone gave it a name. The African settlement movement, the movement that settled Liberia, was informed of an African movement, the so-called Negro Convention movement, which was a discussion of how you bring the African world together. That whole 19th century was Pan-African thought. Prince Hall, the development of the Black Masonic Order, to be called the African Lodge, to search for a place in Africa for settlement by Martin Delaney, Robert Campbell, 1829, David Walker the Peel, because the people of the world was basically a Pan-African appeal. All of this, before we come down to the end of the 19th century, the ultimate Pan-Africans, of course, Jamaica, Marcus
Garvey.
Not listen, not willing to listen.
We have a cry of blood for
goes abroad and to dream the great dream, rescue the mind of millions of black Americans from depression and self-doubt. By 1923, he was in some difficulty with the boats and some of the people he had hired to run the boats, terrible mismanagement, betrayal. He collected millions of dollars from black Americans to buy these boats, and these boats were old and not as seaworthy as he thought they were. Garvin moved over large territory, maybe too fast, and yet he built the largest movement in black America, for Arsene. There needs to be a reassessment of Marcus Garvey and his long-reaching effects. He called attention to what slavery and colonialism had taken away. It took away a concept essential to all the people in the world. They took away the concept of state management and state maintenance. Once you are taken from the geography of your origin and forced to live in a state designed by others, you're still the slave of the man who's astute enough to control a container called the state.
The cannons of World War II were barely cold when Africans met in Manchester, England. They were prepared to claim that container called the state for themselves.
Pan-African Congress of 1945, now you have the one thing you did not have in the rest of them. You have Caribbean scholars, African-American scholars, not a hell of a lot, and Africans themselves are now participating. We're not talking about Africa out of the presence of Africa. Now you're talking about Africa with the Africans on the scene. One African being the co-convener of the conference, Kwame Nkrumah. Out of that fifth Pan-African Congress came the mentality, the basic plan to rule and to take over nations. The others were saying, give us the education. At the fifth Pan-African Congress, they said, we got the education. We got the manpower. We want to rule now.
The people of Ghana resisted British rule from the very beginning. In March of 1957, they become the first Africans to win their freedom. Kwame Nkrumah was ready to rule.
When I knew Nkrumah in the Harlem History Club days, my impression of him was not as the future head of state, but as an African who's going to go back and make a major contribution to his nation. He was a committed African. I went to Africa in 1958 because I've been promising myself I was going to get to Africa the next year. That promise of myself went on about 5 years before I actually got there. When I got there, all I had was a return ticket. I told an African who had read one of my stories in an African magazine and who got my address. I said I was coming to Ghana, get me a place in a hotel for a few days. He didn't even go to a hotel. He didn't try. He took me to the slums of Accra. I lived right there with him. Finally, a check that was due me from America did not arrive. When it did arrive, it bounced. There I was, and one day, the crew had gone someplace. He's coming home from a visit of state. A whole lot of people along the highway hailing his return. And so I was along with the rest of them. I was just black leather African belting into the crowd. And he spotted me, and he stopped the Rolls Royce, and the motorcycle driver pulled that gun, talked to someone about the Russian president, you know. His motorcade stopped it. And he came out. What are you doing in my country? I just left. He's a long way from Harlem. He looked right there. Where do you live? I said in Jamestown. is down to the slums of Accra. Still is. You sure must love Africa. Body heads back to his car and he turns back to me. You know what I'm going to do for you? I told him I didn't have any job and my check is bounced. I didn't even know how I was going to get home. I won't put your Harlem behind to work. He gave me a job working on his newspaper, the Evening News. The significance of God's independence at that time is that it gave spirit to the whole of the African world. It was a major impact on Black America because it came at the time that the civil rights movement was reaching a crescendo, a great height. His first vision of Pan-Africanism was physical unification of Africa. He said that gun and freedom won't mean anything until the rest of Africa is free. So the spirit of Ghanaian independence would create a life of hope in the rest of Africa. This is where Kwame Nkrumah was trying to build. This is what the intelligence services of the United States, England, and France had to destroy to keep the example of Ghana from emerging. What was wrong was I was misunderstanding of what a state is and the responsibility that goes into holding one together and our dependence on our colonial masters more than we anticipated. We who had longed so much for power, we wanted power, power. When we got close enough to touch it, we realized we hadn't even decided what we were going to do with it yet.
I want to take this opportunity to welcome the Gander of the United States, which he knows so well, first citizen of Ghana, President Nkrumah.
I was in the anti-poverty program in Harlem, and when Nkrumah came and spoke at the United Nations, I got the picture, showed it to them, and I got the speech.
Nkrumah came from Howard University, and the people at Harvard University had the first African program, and the people at Howard University was the one that posed to help be a cause, but they didn't because they were so busy getting money from Europeans. And Nkrumah graduated from Harvard University and went back to Africa. And that's what happened.
Have acknowledged the Library of Congress as one of the major and richest depositories for the study of Africa. It is noteworthy that in 1958, E. Franklin Frazier, professor of sociology and director of the Program of African Studies at Howard, and Dr. Dorothy Wesley Porter, eminent curator and supervisor of the university's prestigious Moreland Pingarn collection, were instrumental in advocacy efforts and planning for a national center to acquire, catalog, and preserve library and research materials documenting the history and cultures of the African continent. In 1960, the African section was formally established here at the Library of Congress. The section continues to play a vital role in the library's acquisition program, offers expert reference and bibliographic services to Congress and to an international community of researchers, and maintains liaison with professional associations and research and teaching institutions all over the United States and around the world as well. The section is well known for its bibliographic program, which includes more than 40 bibliographic guides designed to help researchers access the library Africana collections more effectively. A further step in augmenting the growth of the library's Africana collections was the establishment in Nairobi, Kenya, in 1966, of a regional center with responsibility for acquiring current publications in Eastern and Southern Africa. Cultural and scholarly programs and other outreach activities have long been part of the African section's agenda. In 2008, for example, both the Department of African and African Studies and the Ralph Bunche International Affairs Center at Howard University partnered with the library's African section in sponsoring a symposium commemorating the 50th anniversary of Things Fall Apart, one of the most important literary works to come of Africa by the great literary scholar Chinua Achebe. And we currently have an ongoing program called Conversations with African Poets and Writers that is entering its third year now. We're working with the Africa Society of the National Summit on Africa and with the Poetry Center here. And we have six speakers, three in the fall and three in the spring. And I'd like to invite you to come and attend those. There are readings, interviews, and they go all over the sweep of African literature. The Library's Africana Collections provides an extraordinary intellectual record of the study of both the historical and contemporary present-day African nations. Holdings cover virtually every major field of study in the social sciences and the humanities, and include an invaluable body of primary source material in many diverse formats and languages, including materials in African vernacular languages. We have a very significant collection in the vernacular. It is important to note that Howard University Africanist scholars have extended invaluable assistance to specialists in the African section, facilitating a number of professional networks with government officials, librarians, and publishers in the Africa region to support the library's acquisition program. Additionally, Howard scholars have provided expertise to improve bibliographic control of many of our African language resources. At the initiative of Dr. Robert Edgar, new graduate students in Howard African Studies program have met with African section specialists each semester for more than a decade for briefings on library research on Africa-related topics. From these briefings, the African section has benefited greatly from the support of a number of student volunteers and interns who have witnessed the work of the African section specialists in efforts to promote bibliographic control, preservation, and accessibility of the treasures and resources of the library's Africana collection. Today, the African section salutes Howard University's Department of African Studies and its six decades of scholarly achievement. We actually have representative samples of these works from Howard University scholars, by Howard University scholars, who are there for you to look at later if you wish. We also take this opportunity to say thank you for the continuing institutional support and cooperation that you have provided to advance the Library of Congress African Section programs and to promote scholarly research on Africa. Now, the next speaker is Dr. M.B. Shah. And before I introduce him, I'd like to thank him and Dr. Angel Batiste, a Howard graduate and a pillar of African studies here at the library. Together, Dr. Cham and Dr. Batiste organized and made possible the event today. And now let me introduce very briefly Dr. Cham. He is a professor and chair of the Department of African Studies at Howard University. Dr. Cham has received numerous awards from Howard University, including the Howard University Fund for Academic Excellence Travel Award. He has also served as a jury member for prestigious review panels and awards both within and outside Howard University. These include the Paul Robeson Film Awards, Prize Pieces Film and Video Competition, and the annual Rosebud Awards and Competition. Dr. Cham has also presided on the jury on short film competition of the 16th FESPACO Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso 1999, and the feature film and video features jury in Southern Africa Film Festival, Harare, Zimbabwe, 1998. And he has served as a consultant to UNESCO and the World Bank. So, Dr. Cham, I pass on the baton to you.
Good morning. Thank you for those kind words, Dr. Deep. I bring you greetings from Howard University, especially from our deans, Dean Badegation, Supreme Dean College of Arts and Sciences, and Dean Gary Harris, who is also the interim dean of the graduate school, who are not able to be here with us today. But they do send their warm greetings to all of you. Thank you, Dr. Deep, for hosting this particular event here. We are very honored, and thank you very much, Angel, for taking the initiative actually to propose that in support of the series of events that we've been putting up the whole year, that we also have a session here at the Library of Congress, given the important role historically, Dave has just pointed out, Howard scholars have played in enabling, developing the collection here at the Library of Congress. Actually, I was browsing through Rayford Logan's prodigious history of Howard just recently, and he relates some kind of an inside joke or inside anecdote at Howard at the time, where Howard scholars had such a massive, thick, and influential presence in one of the federal government agencies that Howard scholars were going there constantly. They were being called upon constantly to go and give lectures related to Africa, to the diaspora, and all of those other issues there. That Logan said that, you know, Howard scholars started calling that particular department of the U.S. government at Extension Department of Howard University. Now, I think it would be hyperbolic or an exaggeration to say that, you know, the Africa section here is an extension of Howard University. But I think that metaphor really captures the sort of umbilical ties, you know, that have brought together Howard University and the Africa section here. And as Dr. Deep has also pointed out, we are very proud that some of our alumni have been very much a presence in the Africa section of the Africa and Middle East Division here at the Library of Congress. I can go through the names there. There's Angel Basis here. Fantahon Turune was here, is he? Yeah, he's probably on his way here. I think Laverne also. So, exactly. So, you know, well, I guess for our purpose today, we can say that it's an extension of an extension department of Howard University. This is a very exciting moment for us, celebrating 60 years of the graduate program in African Studies at Howard University. But I think if you take a long view, you'll see that the formal establishment of the graduate program in 1953 was really a step to institutionalize, to formalize what has always been a part, in fact, the DNA of Howard University's conception, study of Africa and people of African descent throughout the world. So, excuse me, we are glad that we're able to be here today to celebrate this moment here, and to also take pride in the fact that if you look at institutions all around the world, I think one can, I mean, Howard stands out, not just in terms of being a pioneer in the field, but also in terms of institutionalizing and consistently over the years supporting the study of Africa and the African diaspora institutionally. And it is one of those institutions that don't depend on outside funding, grants, to maintain these programs, as is the case in many other universities. But these are hard institutional monies that have been invested in the study and promotion of this particular area of study. And we're very proud to be here to celebrate that particular moment, 60 years of this institution. So I want to thank all of you for coming and supporting us, and also to thank my colleague who responded enthusiastically when we reached out to them to be part of this moment here. And Dr. Batiste will be introducing them in a moment. So I want to thank all of you again and welcome you on behalf of all the authorities at Howard University. And again, thank you, Dr. Dean, for hosting us here. We're very delighted. Thank you.
I too welcome all of you to the Library of Congress. As an alumni of the Howard University Department of African Studies, I am extremely pleased to salute the department in celebrating a momentous milestone. 6 decades of training African specialists and elevating African studies scholarship. My sincere appreciation goes to our distinguished faculty, Dr. Nyang, Dr. Carr, Dr. Dotson, and Dr. Edgar. I'd like to note that this program is being webcast, and it will be accessible to an international audience on the African and Middle Eastern Division website. It will also be preserved in the library's digital Africana collection. We will be having a break at about 11:15 at this point, and I urge all of you to take a look at the scholarship that has been produced by the faculty of Howard University, the Africanist faculty, and we will also take that time to have coffee and tea. African studies at Howard is rooted in the Pan-African consciousness of an impressive list of prominent Howard University faculty, including Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, and Dr. Charles Wesley, the acknowledged architect of the field of African studies. Adding to this list, we include Professors Ralph Bunch, E. Franklin Frazier, Elaine Locke, Kelly Miller, Rayford Logan, Frank Snowden, John Hope Franklin, Chancellor Williams, Lorenzo Turner Dowell, Joseph Harris, Joseph Applegate, and importantly, the renowned bibliographer, Dr. Dorothy Wesley Porter. The establishment of the African Studies and Research Program at Howard in 1953 and the launching of the nation's first doctoral program in African Studies in 1969 symbolically represent the vision and the relentless efforts of these pioneer Africanist scholars. Today, the Howard University Department of African Studies offers both undergraduate and graduate degrees, and African courses are dispersed throughout the curriculum of the university's discipline-based and professional degree programs. Before we lead into our discussion, I would like to introduce our guest panelists, who will provide a broader insight into the intellectual tradition of African studies at Howard University. Dr. Greg Carr is the Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, an adjunct faculty at the Howard University School of Law. The School District of Philadelphia's first resident scholar on race and culture, Dr. Carr led a team of academics and educators in the design of the curriculum for Philadelphia's mandatory high school African American history course. Dr. Carr is the first vice president of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization. He is co-editor of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization's multi-volume African World History Project. Dr. Carr here. Dr. Dotson, to my right, is the director of the Moreland Spingarn Research Center and Howard University's libraries. A national leader in the movement to preserve African American history, he was formerly chief of the New York Public Library's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, the world's leading repository for materials on Black cultural life. Dr. Dotson served as chair of the Federal Steering Committee for the African Burial Ground and was a member of the President's Commission on the National Museum of African American History and Culture. He also serves on the Scientific and Technical Committee of the UNESCO Slave Route Project. And Dr. Robert Edgar. Dr. Robert Edgar is the professor of African studies, is a professor of African studies at Howard University. His areas of teaching and research include African history, Southern African history, African religions and political movements, and social science research methods. He has served as visiting faculty at universities in the United States and in Lesotho, and has received numerous awards, including the Howard University Faculty Research Award and a three-year grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission for a documentary editing project on African American historical linkages with South Africa from 1890 to 1965. And last but not least, Dr. Suleiman Nyang is professor of African studies at Howard University. From 1986 through 1993, Dr. Nyang served as the chair of the Department of African Studies. He has served as deputy ambassador of the Republic of Gambia to Saudi Arabia and seven other North African and Middle Eastern countries. Dr. Nyang was the founding editor of the American Journal of Islamic Studies, now known as the American Journal of Islamic Social Sciences. He was also the president of the Association of Muslim Social Scientists. Dr. Nyang has served as consultant to several national and international agencies and on the boards of the African Studies Association, the American Council for the Study of Islamic Societies, and the American Islamic Heritage Museum. He was an advising scholar for the award-winning PBS broadcast documentaries, Muhammad, Legacy of a Prophet, and Prince Among Slaves, produced by Unity Productions Foundation. Our discussion format today will... I'm anxious to get to our speech. Our discussion format today will include two sessions. Our first session will be approximately an hour, and I'll be asking our guest panelists to try to limit their presentations to 20 minutes. As a Howardite, I know that can be a bit difficult, but if we could try to limit the discussions to 20 minutes, and following each session, we will have a Q&A. For those who participate in our question and answer, I'd like to note that today's program is being webcast, and by submitting a question, you are agreeing to be a part of our webcast production. After our first hour, we'll be breaking up. Let's say we're running into 10:30 now. About 11:30, we'll break up for a brief coffee and tea break and a view of some of our exhibit items. And I'd like to ask that for those with coffee and tea, If you can stay away from the Africana treasure. So our first panel session will include Dr. Dawson and Dr. Edgar. And Dr. Dawson will be our first speaker. I turn the podium over to Dr. Dawson.
Thank you very much. Let me also, on behalf of Howard University Libraries and the Moreland Spingarn Research Center staff, congratulate the African Studies Department on its 60th anniversary. We share a lot of history together and look forward to sharing more. I had, when I was asked to do this, I had a lot of some level of fear and trepidation being asked to talk about this topic, because I don't claim to be a historian of Howard University, and I don't claim to be an Africanist, though I study African and African diaspora experience as a central part of my own academic and intellectual interest. I've been at Howard now for a little more than about a year and a half, and in my efforts to develop a rational 21st century library program that is aligned with Howard's teaching, research, and learning mission, I've been obliged to delve into its history. Some of the impetus for this particular line of inquiry has been in search of insights into contemporary policies, programs, and academic practices. And most intriguing for me has been questions related to the origin and development of Howard's Moreland Spingarn Research Center. There are a few, official histories that have been written, but I've found a lot of questions unanswered in them, and so I've been probing around trying to get some sense of that. And the reason for this, in part, is because Moreland Spingarn will celebrate its 100th anniversary next year. And so behind these questions have been what appears to me to have been Howard's seemingly at times ambivalent relationship to the study of the Black experience. And I say that knowing that Dr. Chim has already said that it's been there for all of its history, but I'm going to raise some questions about that, I suspect. This ambivalence has seemingly been a part of Howard's founding creed. And while Howard has been a national leader in the study of the Black experience, especially since the 1920s, and while Howard boasts of one of the largest and most distinguished faculties specializing in the study of Black experience in any American university, institutionally, as I look at it, Howard has been seemingly more committed to advancing its role as a center for educating and training Black leadership than it has been committed to the establishment of itself in an organic way, an institutional way, as the leading intellectual authority on the study of global Black experience. This is not to suggest that individual faculty members and indeed some departments, schools, and colleges have not played such leadership roles in the past, nor do I mean to say that individual faculty members and departments and schools are not playing such intellectual leadership roles today, or that they are not engaged in the struggle for intellectual hegemony in these fields. What I do want to suggest is that while Howard pioneered in the development of many of the disciplines and subfields of African and African diaspora experience, Howard as an institution has not maintained that leadership position in many of these areas. And I would like to suggest that, ironically, institutional, Howard's ambivalence about placing teaching and research on the Black experience at the core of its mission is one of the sources of that. There's also institutional ambivalence about the values of study and research. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The Charter of Howard University establishes Howard as a university for the education of youth in liberal arts and sciences. That's in quotes. The education of youth in the liberal arts and sciences. Well, General Earl Howard, the founder of the school, was committed to making Howard an integrated institution. So the charter language avoided specifying a mission that was singularly focused on Black people. The project was funded by the Freedmen's Bureau, and whose express purpose was to prepare the formerly enslaved black population for citizenship and productive economic, political, and social lives as free people. Now, actually, Howard wasn't the only one of the schools that was funded by the Freedmen's Bureau. Indeed, some 21, including Howard, received funding to support the educational development of black folk. For reasons that are not altogether clear to me, Howard left the door open to non-blacks, especially non-black women. The first students enrolled at Howard were not black. They were four white women, daughters of the founders, who ultimately aspired to get to legal careers. And if you know anything about that period of time, women were not admitted to law schools in the country. And so as we cut through the chinks, and I'm afraid to get into it because not. Anyway, as you cut through the chinks, school was actually founded to fund both of those. And it's the way the language was written was to make sure that that second option could in fact be carried out. Now, what is significant for our purposes today is that while the mission, and I should say, and this is the women actually did matriculate in the law school, and well into the 1990s were still matriculating, but they made a decision that they needed to get away from men, and so they moved and set up their own independent women's law school. And no blacks were admitted, but that's another story. What is significant for our purposes today is that while the mission of the university was to educate black folk, there were no provisions for teaching them about themselves, about their African origins and cultures, of their experiences as enslaved Africans in the United States or throughout the Americas. There are likely at least two reasons for this oversight. The first one, the very unwisdom of the 19th century and before, was that black people had no history and culture. And this myth was part of the ideological justification for slavery and for blood. Europeans, at least Africans, were pagan savages, devoid of civilization or any history. And hence, there was nothing really to teach them about themselves. Ironically, And there was this notion, too, that the history of black folk, enough information to say anything about them anyway. Now, ironically, as late as the 1960s and early 70s, variations on this theme were being raised to question the intellectual viability of establishing black studies programs. So almost 100 years after Howard is around, they're still raising questions about whether or not there's this field of study of black folk has intellectual viability. The Congregational Missionaries who founded Howard, like the abolitionist brothers and sisters, were opposed to slavery and to racial oppression. They did not, however, embrace the notion that Africans or the formerly enslaved freedmen were or ever could become equal to white. More of the concept of education that the founders brought to their missionary enterprise also precluded any serious intellectual engagement with the histories and cultures of the human beings they proposed to educate. And so, as has been the case in missionary enterprises on the African continent and in Asia and other parts of the world, the educational function in missionary enterprises was, in fact, to civilize the natives, to pass on the knowledge of, and civilization that Europeans had to them, rather than to try to tell them anything about themselves or have them learn anything about themselves. So that's a kind of context in which we ask ourselves and have to ask ourselves where do we begin to find some space at Howard for teaching and studying and researching the histories and heritage of people of African descent. Now, since the first decade of the 20th century, Howard has been pridefully referred to as the capstone of Negro education. This reference derived from Howard's status as the largest and most comprehensive of the colleges and universities that primarily served African Americans and other people of African descent. Established by, as I said before, education for youth in liberal arts and sciences, Howard successfully defended and affirmed the value of liberal arts education for blacks and fended off efforts to displace industrial education. The struggle between the two educational philosophies was carried out in many tangible ways on Howard's campus itself. And I'll just mention this very briefly. Booker T. Washington was invited to serve on the board of Howard University in 1907. And he joined the board